Welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram, the show where voices rise, truth matters, and community leads the conversation. Today, we're delving deep into a powerful discussion led by organizers from the NAACP, joined by the brilliant minds behind the book Dreams Deferred, a timely and necessary work co-authored by three powerful voices committed to telling the real story of Black America. Dreams Deferred is not just the title, it's a question. What happens when a people's promise is delayed, denied, or ignored? So stay with us as we talk literature, legacy, and liberation right here on What's Going On with Earl Ingram. Don't miss it. Airing this week on all streaming platforms. Follow us on civicmedia.us or wherever you follow your podcast. Please like and subscribe as well. Welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. I'm excited more so now than I have been in all of the past podcasts that we've done, and for many different reasons. I'm born and raised in the city of Milwaukee, and I've seen a lot of things, a lot of changes take place in the city over my 71 years of living, and I've seen things that have taken place that I've always questioned, and yet there were no answers. And so today we're going to talk to some people who have some answers about something that has troubled me and bothered me for the majority of my life. When you live in a city that is about 45-46% Black or whatever it is, and yet you see almost, even today, almost 50% Black male unemployment, it's unconscionable. And there are a lot of different reasons why. Well, this morning, in the first segment of a wonderful book that's been written called Dreams Deferred by two people who I've known for a number of years, and one being my mentor, none other than Mr. Paul Blackman. We'll get into who he is in a few minutes, and then Ms. Freda Webb, who has been very instrumental in the political world and realm in our city, especially as it relates to Blacks and unions. And the third person that I don't know, Ms. Ruth Zabrinsky, and I guess we'll get a chance to talk about her, but I will say to you that this is more than an interesting subject. It really should be criminal at the root of what has taken place. So many times I hear people say, well, you people don't want to work. There's still, in 2025, there's still people who still use the verbiage, you people don't want to work. Well, there are a lot of different reasons why so many young Blacks are struggling and males are struggling. They haven't been given the same opportunities. That's a hard pill to swallow in 2025. And with that backdrop, I want to introduce the authors of Dreams Deferred, 6 Decades of Discrimination Against African Americans in Milwaukee Construction Industry. We'll start with Ms. Freda Webb.
Good morning. My name is Freda Webb. I'm a local resident of Milwaukee, born and raised, went to high school here, and got some chance to meet some people I would not otherwise have met by happenstance through in the construction industry. And that basically gave me a whole new education in regard to gainful employment and why more of us, even though I know many African Americans who have skill sets related to the construction industry, they're not members of the union and are not gainfully employed in most of these union contracts. And when I see all these projects going on and I see the absence, I always think of what does this payroll look like? What would it, if I could pull up the payroll, what would the race makeup and diversity be? And so to the extent that I see these jobs going on and I see the absence of people of color, I know we're missing a great opportunity, and this book is about trying to educate and correct that.
You know, Freda, before we go to Paul, I have to ask you another time in your life were involved politically in this city, and the fact that you have drilled down and you have that background politically, did it help when you were writing this book?
Having been a congressional aide and gone into many rooms that I was the only black person and black female, it helps to have experience there and know that it's important that you be there and that you come and that you make relationships where you can. And as a result of that, that led me to the connection I made with Plumbers Local 75, as well as Labor's Local 113, and the formation and the importance of the group that resulted, the Skilled Trades Collaborative, which it was important for a group of people of color who were the beneficiaries of mentors like Vince Turan to basically have a way to give back, or try to have a way to give back, even though it was ignored in many respects. But just because it was ignored don't mean we didn't make a difference in some way, somehow.
So we're going to get into all those things as we drill down on Dreams Deferred. And I would be remiss if the man to my left, none other than Mr. Paul Blackman, whom I met when I was about a 21-year-old kid, working at a place called A.O. Smith where my father worked. It was a place that I never gave much thought about. When the open housing came into existence and we were able to move from 4th and Monarchy, really a segregated community that provided everything that we needed, to an area that was predominantly white up to 25th and Townsend. I saw A.L. Smith for the first time. I didn't know what A.L. Smith was. My father worked there, but I knew I worked in a drugstore, and I knew that guys would come there and before they go to work, and all of them had great cars and a lot of money. And so I'm from a family of 13, and I saw all that, and I said, well, let me follow my dad. And I was one of six sons, and I was the only one that went into A.L. Smith, but I never knew why, especially early on, other than the money. But this gentleman was a strong black man, and not just that his name is Black Man, but he was a strong black man, and I'm a young man coming from the civil rights era and watching H. Y. Brown, Stokely Carmichael, Eldridge Cleaver, Huey P. Newton, Fred Hampton, Bobby Seale, Mega Evers, Elijah Muhammad, Dr. King, and Malcolm X, and all those people. And so that was permeating my soul as a young man. And so when I walked into A.L. Smith and I saw this man, diminutive guy, wasn't a big guy, but what he was a guy who demanded no respect. And we're talking about a plant that was, it was 70% white, at least 70% white, and yet even the white people respected this man. So Paul Blackman saw something in me as a young guy, something I didn't see in myself. And whoever and whatever I am now has a lot to do with the fact that I met this man, and he helped change my life and bring a perspective to me that I was more than the guy who worked on the line. So I never told you that, Paul, but you influenced my life dearly. Whoever and whatever I am now has a lot to do with the fact that I was so blessed to have had you in my life at a young time. But Paul Blackman, the president of the Smith Steelworkers 19806 for 20 years, and man, I'm so happy to see you, happy to know that you're still around and that you're still fighting. He's one of the authors of Dreams Deferred. Paul, what do you want to say?
Well, thanks. My beginning, I was born in Chicago, Illinois, on the south side. And in Chicago, Illinois, all the black people, we were tough, because we had to be. But my sister begged me to come to Milwaukee because she needed some help, and so I came to Milwaukee. But I came to Milwaukee with this attitude that I had achieved from being on the south side of Chicago. And if anybody knows anything about the south side of Chicago, you gotta be tough to survive. But anyway, she talked me into coming to Milwaukee, and I knew that right away I had to get a job, and so I got a job at Alesmith. And when I found out what was going on at Alesmith, I just couldn't. I had to get some people together, and we were talking about the things were happening at Alesmith and how black people were being ignored. And so I put together an organization. And for some reason, they thought because I was so vocal, they decided to put me in charge of a group to try and get people to elect us as officers in the union. And that happened, and they elected me as president. And as a result of that, I was president, I guess, maybe 6-7 weeks before I found out what was really going on at Alesmith. And I convinced the people that we needed to ask Alesmith for certain wages, that everything was down, and if they didn't, we would take them out on strike. And that's what we did. We asked them for wages. They said no. We took them out on strike. The largest manufacturer of automobile truck frames in the world, we took out on strike. And that's what started. That's what started my reputation. And I was, there were only, I guess, 8-9% of the people that worked at Alesmith were black. The rest of them were white. But because of my attitude, the white people just took to me, and they elected me president. And I was president for the Smith Steelworkers for 20 years. I remember I was there maybe 2 years before I took them out on strike. And it was all over the United States that the largest manufacturer of automobile truck frames was on their strike for the first time. And the thing they didn't want to talk about is that the president of the union was black. And they were really shocked when they found out that everybody was really shocked to find out that the union that had taken the largest manufacturer of automobile and truck frames in the world out on strike was black. But they played that down. They didn't. For some reason, and you can understand why, they didn't want to modify that. And so that's how I started my reputation as.
And you know, Paul, what people may not, and what I think people need to understand, is there were over 6,000 people who were working there at that point in time, and that Alesmith produced automobile frames and truck frames for almost every Ford, Chrysler, General Motors, or Freightliner, all of the major trucks. We produced them all, so we were able to shut down those businesses. Little Alesmith, and I remember it like yesterday. Because I think we were only on strike for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It wasn't very long.
2 weeks, yeah.
But you brought them to their knees.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's been an honor. It's good to see you. But you know, you're still at it, and so let's fast forward to where we are now. and that's this book called Dreams Deferred. And so I want to go back and Preeta, you and I, you're born and raised in Milwaukee?
I went to high school here, came shortly after I was born in Niles, Michigan.
So we're kind of like lifelong Milwaukeeans. And so we've seen some things happen in this city that we know have not been right as it relates to equality for blacks and in many different areas, but especially in the trades. And for people who don't know and they think about the trades, and it covers so many different broad areas of the trades, but yet I've never seen, I know as a young man growing up, those trades were almost 100% white, right? I mean, you didn't see black people, period, in the trades.
No, I think you saw very few. Milwaukee Tech was one of the schools, as a result of doing a report called the Contra Report, that was a result of a U.S. Supreme Court decision, Croson versus Richmond, whereby the Association of General Contractors challenged the city of Richmond in regard to their minority participation program. That basically brought my attention to the fact that minority programs were a result of formal discrimination. And in order for governmental entities who had established goals on various contracts to basically maintain these goals, this Supreme Court decision said, you have to prove that discrimination exists. And as a result of being part of that study, I was able to go out and talk to minority tradespeople and minority small businesses in particular who were seeking to be part of the trades in many respects, who hadn't done a traditional trade, basically say, if not but for these goals on these programs, I would not be able to have this role in this public contract. And if not for these city requirements or these public requirements, this small business would not exist.
So this book is full of laws and statutes. As I was reading it the first time around, I said, wow, man, all this stuff is documented. And it's been documented for the better part of 50 years. This was spelled out to address what was going on 50, 60 years ago. And yet, here we are 50, 60 years later, and even though all these laws and statutes are in place and have been in place, we still find ourselves having moved very little in opening the doors for equality as it relates to, you know, these trades.
Correct. Well, people with money are the powers that be. Unions and contractors have the money and the influence. And even though elected officials establish goals and objectives, they fail in many respects to enforce them because of the effect and the desire of the powers that be not to want them changed. So say Miller Park had a goal on it, and that goal basically said that X amount of these contracts and workers should be people of color from the community. And in many respects, there were. And there were some relationships that were established as a result. But that was as a result of what was called the Philadelphia Plan, that one of the people who we mentioned in the book, who was a member of our committee, who's no longer with us, Elmer Anderson, sure, was at a conference on the East Coast and basically had heard about the city of Philadelphia challenging the federal government about all these construction projects going on in their city and the absence of African Americans. And they made enough noise to basically get the Labor Department Secretary, George Shultz, who worked for President Nixon's attention. And he basically allowed his staff person, Arthur Fletcher, who was an African American, to basically look and investigate federal contracts across the country. And he confirmed that there was an absence of people of color, African Americans, on these contracts that were millions of dollars. And as a result of that, they established that any contract over $500,000 should and was required to have blacks on it who were available and willing to be a participant. And they monitored for a while. There was an ebb and flow of attention. And as a result of that, Elmer came back to Milwaukee and called on the building trades and other stakeholders and governmental officials to basically create and introduce something. And after about 2 years, they finally basically agreed to work with him and establish what became, they hired Elmer Anderson, not Elmer Anderson, they hired Vince Turan to basically do this and go out to Milwaukee Public Schools and identify the people who had been exposed to voc technical education and say, there's an opportunity for you to pursue a career in the construction trades as a journey person. And this is what Vince Turan did, and he oversaw people who basically, who now are retired for the most part.
So, you know, Frieda, why people should be concerned about this, and what many people who are listening may not know, the reason that these are, the trades are such prized jobs is because the amount of money they make. They make more money than people with PhDs in many instances. And the fact that these tradespeople, an electrician or steam fitter or a carpenter, not only makes money on his job, but because of his trade, he can certainly moonlight in other areas and make almost as much, if not more. And so they make more money than people with the highest of degrees. And so that's part of what keeps this fraternity close-knit. And the rules and the laws be damned, they're not going to open the door for everybody. It's only for special people.
But yes, these are basic skills. These are skills that no society can live without. Everybody wants shelter. They want heat. They want air conditioning. They want water. They want roofs, and et cetera. These are basic skills. These are critical skills needed all over the world. And not only is this a case in Milwaukee, this is a case anywhere in the United States or the world. And so one's ability or opportunity to learn these skill sets and be connected to an employer who basically will hire you and let you implement these skill sets and then basically get to know whomever are the best of the best makes you an invaluable worker. And if you decide to create your own business, that's how it starts. The thing is, how do you learn these skills? And how do you get in, where's the door you enter? And that's what most people don't know. Someone who's engaged and employed formally in these skills and basically is a part of a union or works for a contractor who's sizable and basically is part of the major projects that go on.
You know, Frieda, I always think of it from this perspective. We're talking about now that the debate is on about whether AI is going to be eliminating all these jobs and white collar jobs. And in some instances, it's true. But AI can never replace a plumber, a carpenter, an electrician. It is, those jobs are now prized. They've always been prized, but especially even more so now than before. But you've got all these laws in place that said, this is the United States of America, affirmative action, and all those different things that were fought for and sworn into law have been actually dismissed, and they have not been followed. And even to this day, we're probably even worse off today in numbers, sheer numbers, even though the numbers of blacks have increased exponentially in this country and in this city, that the percentages of them on these sites have diminished.
In many respects, blacks left the South for employment. They came to Wisconsin, and Wisconsin was known as a manufacturing state. Many of them basically got into manufacturing, A.L. Smiths and et cetera. Some of them basically at various times have brought skills, these skills from the South. But right. When they came to the North, they were not allowed to be, they were not employed and say, where do I go to enter the door to basically become employed as a plumber or electrician or a plasterer or brick mason? Those doors were not easy to find. And when they did find them, they questioned their skill sets, even though they had been trained in other states. And therefore, the opportunity for people to who have these skills to basically stay employed, and then for others to pursue this, because did not grow. And it was not to the ebb and flow of certain laws or certain evolutions in activities like the Philadelphia Plan and other affirmative action laws that there was an effort to say, we got to increase these numbers. And to some extent, there was some ebb and flow, and a few people got in the door. The trades don't work like there's not an ad in the paper. They didn't advertise these positions. You didn't know what was required. If you didn't meet somebody along the way who was in this job, then you wouldn't basically probably know how to get in there. And therefore, those people who did have some basics and did basically sought to pursue it, now what they do is you get a letter. If you pass a written test, if you first appear for oral interview, after the oral interview, you take the aptitude test. If you pass the aptitude test, then you get an interview. Then if you get an interview and your oral interview and your written tests are high enough, then you get what they call a hunting license. And then you have permission to go out and introduce yourself to an employer. That means a job start at 7 o'clock. You need to be there by 6:30 and find out who on that job site is in charge and introduce yourself to that person and see if they will hire you in whatever respective trade you're seeking to basically pursue. And that if you don't have success, say within a couple of months, you are give up. That is, you have to have some determination. So if you haven't met someone along the way who may speak up for you, like I met someone who spoke up for me and somebody else spoke up for whatever else. I'm not a trades person, I'm a consultant. So that's a different door I came in, okay? But the whole thing is having someone who says, give this person a chance. And that person then gets a chance. And then after they get a chance, if something happens, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, okay? There's some experiences that you get people who almost completed their apprenticeship, a five-year apprenticeship, and they want to throw them off the job after, say, 4 years. Why would you do that after all this investment? Except this person is a person of color, and they don't have nobody to basically advocate for them.
So Paul, there are many different layers to this cake. So a person, you would think that they have the background, they've done the math, and they qualified for the position. And yet, it's really still up to the employer on whether or not they're going to follow these laws and other things that are put in place. You're really at the mercy of somebody who could very easily discriminate against you. Is it safe to say that?
Yes, because that's what's happening with Trump. He's ignoring all of the laws that have been established and all of the things that have been established here. He's ignoring all of that. And that's why he's such a problem. And the thing that bothers me is that the Democrats who know that are not saying enough, and they're not doing enough. And it reminds me of, look, if I'm a Democrat and I'm an officer and I've been a Democrat 20 years, I don't want to sacrifice. You know, I've got what I need, and so I may say a little something, but I'm not going to say too much. And that's what's happening right now, is that the Democrats are not facing Trump and showing what Trump is doing that's against everything that this country's ever done in the past before. Trump is the number one person who are doing things that have never been done by anybody else in this country. And a lot of Democrats who are in a position to really put a stop to that have have just not stood up the way that they should. And that's why we're in the, we've got the problem that we've got now.
So Frieda, let me ask you. This nation that's supposedly built on, you know, democracy, right? You can, whatever that definition is, you and I know that democracy is different for you and I than it is for most others. When you have this, it's kind of built, this is built on a house of cards. The trades are built on a house of cards, because even though you can follow all those different paths and qualify and all, it's, you're still at the mercy of somebody who can determine your future, whether or not you're qualified or not. And so, and the way this thing is set up, the checks and balances that should be in place to protect American citizens, whether they're black or whomever, does not exist, or it's weak, or it needs to be, there needs to be some foundation to it. The reason that I think it hasn't moved towards equality in this is because there doesn't appear to be people who are concerned about what's taking place here. It doesn't have any relevance to the people who are in power.
Well, necessity's the mother of opportunity, okay? When we came here, when we were brought here, basically whites needed labor. Whites left Europe, cheap labor. Whites left Europe because they were not part of the elite class. They came to America to become the elite class, and they basically identified a group of people that they could identify by color to basically perform jobs that they didn't want to perform, that they could build wealth as a result of it. And as a result of building that wealth, they built other things and influence. And though that influence on in the name of democracy allowed them to basically perpetuate wealth, and that wealth established certain things. And as a result of establishing that structure, one of those things that came out of it was unions. And while unions have done many good things, they also are part of some things that the building trades are key to, which is basically suppressing people of color in regard to opportunities to enter gainful employment. Blacks can do anything when it don't pay and don't have benefits. When it has benefits and pays good wages, when people question our ability, can't, that we can do it, or are we interested, okay? So it's about wealth and power that all this stuff is built upon, okay? So skill sets give you a lot of, give you some wealth, they give you some power, and that power eventually gives you some wealth. And they know no society can exist without these basic skill sets. Roads, houses, air conditioning, heating, and etc. And so how do you learn these skills in regard to who trusts you for these skills in regard to a multi-million dollar contract? You need to know somebody who has these skills who can give you the opportunity to maintain employment, so that employment can basically allow you to learn all the intricacies of this. And this is learning the intricacies of, one, the hands-on skill sets as well as the relationship skill sets is what is the challenge. And therefore, also, while people complain about crime, when people lose hope, crime perpetuates itself, but they don't want to make this connection that crime and opportunity are at the intersection of a quality of life.
So Frieda, it's one thing if we're talking private contracts, right? Although, excuse me, it shouldn't be that. But when we're talking about government contracts, it's a whole different ball game. But we see the same kind of reality happening in the private contracts that are happening in the government contracts. And people are being denied where the government is supposed to enforce it, and yet it's not happening on that level.
Correct. There's all these intricacies of relationships. Elected officials get elected because they have people make donations, and those donations result in people working for the campaigns, and as a result of people working for the campaigns, they get elected. And then they also provide some other fluffs as well. So the whole thing is that you have a system built upon a level of corruption that's allowable, that basically excludes people of color. And there is not an acknowledgement made, although there is now a coming acknowledgement based upon the fact that the present workforce of skilled workers, half of them are eligible to retire in the next 5 years. If those half of those workers retire in the next 5 years, there'll be a lack of people who can basically help contractors, companies, maintain that wealth because they won't have the people who have the skill sets. So now there's a rule about what they call the apprentice to journeyman. How many people can a journeyman train, one journeyman to one apprentice, or two apprentices to a journeyman, so that we can get more people in the pipeline? Because if you don't have people in the pipeline who are being trained, and it takes about 5 to 10 years to really, most apprenticeships are 3 to 5 years. And then after you get the basics, you need to get the job experience, commercial, residential, and et cetera. So it takes about 10 years to really get a skilled, comfortable tradesperson.
Right.
So if you don't have that pipeline of training going on, you're not going to have that level of expertise available to a person to earn a living, as well as a contractor to basically be the one who can build a job, do a job like Miller Parks said. They always say a lowest responsible, responsive contractor. How fast can you build it based upon means how many skill sets, how many people do you have with the skill sets that basically can do this job and do it correctly, okay? So the selfishness is reaching a point of no return because the number of people of color are surpassing the number of white people. And on one hand, there's a fear, but on the other hand, if you don't train people, you ain't gonna have the skill sets to have a quality of life. And then just like the situation kind of that happened in Texas, you don't even have people, you have, the Trump administration has suppressed certain FEMA and et cetera, where you won't have people telling people you need to evacuate, okay? All these things are interrelated. You need skill sets. You need a number of people who have the skill sets and have the backbone, because there's somebody who knew who said, I didn't have permission to basically call that, okay? So here we are with people who need to be in the skilled trades and stipulations in the contract. Now they can't say race, but they can say local city residents. And someone has to make sure that those residents are not only laborers, but they are apprentices, so that they are getting this job, is providing the training, the skill sets, and the income that they need to basically stay engaged and the society can basically be healthy and desirable.
This book is full of the jargon of what should be done. It's already been written, but yet it's not being enforced. And so at the root of all of this is the lack of enforcement. And so how do we begin? Where do you begin? What is the process? Because unless the enforcement takes place, the rest of it is...
I always ask people now, when you pass a job, tell me how many people of color you see. If you don't see people of color on that job, call your elected official, whether it be city, county, or whether, and say, this job is being done with our tax money and none of us on there, we in trouble. Y'all got to do something about that. So those are the things, trying to break it down and see where all the interrelationship of these projects you see going on are basically funded by tax dollars. If those tax dollars are not supporting people from the community, then we got a problem. Because if those people from the community are not, don't have the opportunity to earn a living and pay their rent and take care of their kids and buy a car, then we got a problem.
So what I'm hearing is it's incumbent upon the citizenry to police it.
Everybody has a role here. Not any one of us, but you, when you see a lack of accountability, how do you get accountability? You have to create understanding information at all levels, as many levels as possible, so those people who understand use their influence to call upon other people and say, something's wrong here, okay? You got to do something about it. We got to do something about it, okay? We want this crime to go down. We got to see more people gainfully employed, okay?
So Mr. Blackman, A.O. Smith not only had the Smith Steelworkers 1906, we had all the other trades. And so when you negotiated and when you sat around at the table, you were sitting around with the other trades as well. And so with all those different trades that we had working collectively at A. O. Smith, the one thing I noticed is we saw the exact same thing. There were a handful of blacks who were on those trades. And to be quite frank with you, I often wondered, you know, who polices that? I know it wasn't the Smith Steelworkers' responsibility and you, but we knew that those things were happening, and yet things haven't changed much at all today. We're talking 40 years ago. Is there ever going to be a change, Paul, that you can see?
No, it wasn't. And you see, here's what you have to understand. White people know that they're only 10% of the world's population. They know that. And they know that if they don't keep control, they will disappear. Because there's one thing that bothers them, and that's the female white. Because she says she wants somebody what? Tall, dark, and handsome. And so whites can disappear. All right? They understand that. They understand that more than any other race. That's why they've got a gun in every room. They are in control. They want to be in control. And they are in control. If there's a union, they are in control of that union, and they're going to keep that union that's going to be predominant white. They're going to run everything. They have to do that because they know if they don't do that, they will disappear.
Paul,
they ain't got no choice.
Paul, you know, I'm not questioning any of the things you are saying, but when I look at all these, you know, timelines and laws and all those things that are in place, can't we challenge, shouldn't we be challenging and forcing them to live up to these standards that are in writing?
Not unless you're in control. Not unless you own the police department.
So the army.
You're in control of the army.
So
the control. Then you can do it.
They aren't worth the paper that they're written on.
No. No. Absolutely not. And we have to understand that. See, white people are the only people that really understand what's going on in this world. And how to, because they know. They know. They're only 10%. If they ain't got a gun in every room, if they don't figure out how they're going to control this and control that, they're going to disappear.
Paul, you know, the grandchildren and great-grandchildren and their futures are at stake in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say to my generation, what we have to do before we leave here, we have a responsibility. And part of this book that I've read a couple times, now I'm going to read it again to make sure that I do understand, is that this has to be fixed. This has to be fixed. And so we can't accept anymore. America's the greatest place in the world to live. It's the greatest place in the world, and the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and all that stuff doesn't matter if you're not going to uphold these things that make and render people equal.
Let me tell you what's important. And that's our young people.
Yes. Yes.
Our young people.
Yes.
I'm talking about in grade school.
Yes.
Grade school. That's where we have to start with our young people in grade school. and have them understand what's really going on. What's really going on. That's what we need to do. You see, because the reason why white people are in charge of everything, because they understand. And they know how to do it. We don't understand.
Well, the playing field has not been level is one of the reasons that we don't understand.
The reason the playing field is not level, because white people don't want it.
I know.
Anything that you say that this is not going on, just because white people don't want it. You have to understand that. And when you learn, listen, the first people on this earth were black people. We were the first ones on this earth. We need to know our history. That's one people they don't teach in schools like they should, is the history of black people from the beginning. Because if our young kids knew, hell, we're the first people on this earth. What the hell am I doing in the back of the room? Why am I over here? Why am I, you know? Why every time I read the papers, white this, white that, white the other thing? We have got to start teaching our children. And I see some kids, young kids in fourth and fifth grades that are reading and talking, and that's where we need to start. We can't wait till high school no more.
You know, let me transition to freedom. So Paul talked about school and the importance of school. And as I was reading in the book, and I spoke with you earlier today, I'm from the era where it was mandatory that every young man, every young student, high school student, before you graduated, you had to have wood shop, mechanical, drawing, and metal shop. Those weren't electives. It was mandatory that you had to have those. And so you, and in the book, it talked about the fact that Milwaukee Public Schools chose to get away from the trades, the training. I used to always ask the question, why? Why did the MPS get rid of the mechanical drawing, the wood shop, and those things? Because it was what kind of led me to my 34 years in A.O. Smith. I enjoyed doing the thing with my hands. And so during those times, it wasn't just A.O. Smith, Allen Bradley, Alex Chalmers. We were the machine shop of the world. And so you could be 18 years old like I was and walk into a place that afforded you a guaranteed middle-class lifestyle and the American dream. That's what this was. And you began that by learning how to measure, how to read a rule, how to read a tape, what inches were, how to divide, fractions, all those things were tied into those early stages of trades that we had when we were young boys in middle school and then in high school. MPS somehow, and I used to always ask the questions, why did they do away with that? Why did they take that out?
It coincided with a number of things. MPS's withdrawing or reducing the number of voc technical educations coincided with the man going to the moon and teachers, college-educated teachers, having an issue with the teachers who basically taught the trades, who were tradespeople who were earning more than they did. And that created friction of a sort. And that friction basically allowed someone to basically say, okay, we're going to focus on college education. We won't have tradespeople in here, and these tradespeople won't be earning more than college-educated teachers, okay? And therefore, that education and information went away. That coincided with the fact that also there was being more contractors were seeking to, companies were seeking to make more money and basically exporting their work to other countries. They were exporting their work to other countries because they could get the work done cheaper, and if they got the work done cheaper, they were making a greater profit. That coincided with the fact that unemployment went up in America and was going, and that the information you get as a and the education you get as a result of being employed gives you a lifestyle. That lifestyle and that understanding and that education went away from many families. Right now, NPS has the majority of his families are poor, and no one in that family is gainfully employed. And therefore, not only is there no income, but there's no education. That information you get from getting up and going to work every day is not there. So that level of enthusiasm and hope and determination that you have is lacking. Those invaluables are lacking. And until we put those valuables back, which is basically we have to embrace Milwaukee Public Schools and any public school system are the majority of the workforce that their entity will have.
Right.
Until we acknowledge that that value is there, and therefore we need to basically provide not only that child but that family with the wraparound services they may or may not have, so that we develop an attitude, and not only and they develop an attitude, but we provide opportunities as they develop an attitude so that they prepare for opportunities that are that provide a gainful income.
I would say to you that you certainly categorized it perfectly. But you know where who is going to turn around the train? It's one track, and so Milwaukee Public Schools can't. There is no alternative track for them to turn around, and then you've got all the other options in education that make it almost impossible to do what you're saying is what has to happen?
I think some things are happening beyond our control. Those things like climate change, like that situation that happened in
right.
Texas, and that water that came in and swallowed up all those children,
right.
And you know who sent people in there to help? Mexico.
Right.
Mexico sent people in there to help, and then they had the nerve to question them, but the waters keep coming. Climate change is going to force us to basically reduce our pettiness, because who's going to build all these houses back again? Those houses that were went through the fire in California, Altadena, that black community,
yes.
And not only the black community, but the white community in Hollywood. You better have some people with some skills who can build these houses, okay? Because otherwise, you're going to be sleeping outside for I don't know how long, okay? And not only are you going to be sleeping outside, you're going to be freezing and roasting outside, okay? So there is some force in the universe that is basically seems to be trying to call our attention to the fact that we better change some of our stupid ways.
So what I want to say is we're going to stick a pin in it for now, but we've got at least a couple more segments that we're going to talk about to really get a real grasp on what dreams deferred really entail. So I want to say thank you very much for this first segment, Frieda Webb and my good friend Paul Blackman. But I want you guys to know this is just the beginning of what's going to be a long and fruitful conversation, and questions should be asked about why, because it's not getting any better. Until we have our next conversation, thank you very much.
Thank you.